If our tenor, Charles Forsythe, can appreciate what it would mean to have Mario Lanza sing just ahead of him, he will understand how I feel when Ron Huckins speaks just ahead of me. Late on Saturday night, I groan and gargle, and on Sunday morning, I drink lemon juice in an attempt to have a decent voice. And he gets up, and the thunder just rolls out. Permanently incapacitate me, Ron, if you do that very often. We have a number of guests today, several of whom are well known to you, so be looking for them back visiting us. And among them, the Naces, once of Idaho, where I was entertained graciously in their home on a Pacific Northwest trip, and now I think from Seattle or close by, visiting Jim and Karen Wakefield. Please make all our visitors feel warmly welcome in this place. And to help them feel welcome, let me make a little demur that I make sometimes, but I probably need to make this morning. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of this station or its sponsors. If your views on some of the issues I referred to are different from mine, and they will be here and there, please be patient and forgiving. And if I do nothing else, let me strengthen you in what you already believe, however different it may be from my point of view. This morning's sermon is the kind I do sometimes under the title of potpourri, that odd-looking French word that once meant a mix of dried flowers kept in a pot for their fragrance, and then came to mean a medley of musical or literary pieces, and finally came to describe any mix of unrelated things or topics. The literal meaning of the word potpourri is rotten pot, a meaning I hope this sermon does not revive. Here is topic number one. I was sorting through some old pictures the other day when I found, quite by accident, one of my dad down on one knee in a croquet game, aiming for a wicket, playing with me and my sister. Even in that faded old print, he looked intense. And as I sat there studying his face through a magnifying glass, I had the pleasure of feeling very close to him again. One of the things I remember best is that he was one of the most competitive human beings that ever lived. He lost gracefully, without grumbling or resentment. When the game was over, for him, it was over. But while the game was on, whatever it might be, he played as if his life and the destiny of the world depended on it. He passed a lot of that on to his son, for better or for worse. And in recent years, I've been trying to figure out just where competition fits into one's profession of Christianity. I grew up wanting to win any contest I entered. I think I played for the joy of playing, but it was a great deal more joyous when I won. There was always a kind of drivenness that, like everything else in life, has been both good and bad. I did more things than I would have done without the drive my father implanted. But the competitive spirit has kept me at times from understanding those who are not driven by that spirit. And I am sure it has ministered at times to pride. So I wonder about the feeling so prevalent in America that winning is everything. It seems to me that some of the people I watch have not yet made up their minds about this matter. They tell their children and their friends that they only want them to do their best, but what they congratulate them for publicly in a variety of ways is for winning, not for maximizing their potential, but for beating whoever else showed up to compete that day. How should a Christian view winning? How does it translate for our kids in school? Do your best, we tell them. But does that mean concentrating on one area to the exclusion of others so that we can be sure of winning? On books to the exclusion of athletics? I did the reversal deliberately. On sports to the exclusion of having a wide circle of friends? On any of these things to the cultivating of an interest in what a church does? How do we balance life? I could have produced more writing if I had neglected my teaching. I could have written and taught better if I had neglected my family. I could have done more of both if I had neglected church. What is a balanced life? There are people who haven't won because they gave up a more prestigious job to serve where they were needed more, staying home to care for children instead of heading up a civic group or devoting countless hours to painting or to music. How hard it is to judge the importance of quiet decisions like that. I guess what I feel and what I'm trying to say is that for every person who wears a blue ribbon, accepts an Oscar, sees her name in print under the heading First Place, there are a dozen others who have won in quiet ways, who are heroic, and who in the lovely language of one of my favorite Hebrew scriptures maintain the fabric of this world. Competition is useful and it's exciting, but it really needs no advocate. No one in America has to exalt the values of competition. We glorify being first. We celebrate the joy of winning. I've been a part of that all my life, but what I remind you of this morning is this. Don't forget to praise your helpful child. Your child who does not seem to care so much as you do about winning, but who is quick to praise and encourage others. The world will not be saved only by the great athlete, by the beautiful, by the retentive memory, or the quick study. There are ways to win that the world knows not of. Is that the gospel truth? I think it is. Now for the questions. And you've been listening beautifully, but you need to listen even harder. Because this is the kind of thing you should read and not hear. It goes by too fast when you're listening. A friend of mine in Texas has published an article in which he wonders if it is okay to wonder. He's a bright man, and no matter how absurd his question may sound at first hearing, it will provoke profound religious thought if you give it a chance. So you need to listen and think hard for a moment. Two of his questions are about evolution, although he never mentions the word. I wonder why it is, he writes, that in Bible class artwork for children, we never see any dinosaurs entering the ark with the other animals. And his second question, I wonder how the kangaroos got from the ark to Australia, how they got there, and why they suppressed their reproductive instincts till they got there, so that they left no progeny in other parts of the route they took. I'm just wondering, looking at you and wondering what the mind is doing with that. He intends to provoke some thought about literalism in reading the Bible when he says, I wonder what the carnivorous animals ate on the ark. And I wonder why we have no interview recorded with Lazarus after his being raised from the dead. And I wonder why we have no biography of Jesus written by his mother. He has thought, as any reader will have done, about how little of this planet is fit for life, and how little of the whole universe appears to us to be useful. I wonder, he writes after his Western trip, what God had in mind when he made Utah. And I wonder why God made such an incomprehensibly vast universe when such an infinitesimal part of it would be inhabited by human beings or serve their needs. They're good questions. On other topics, close to home, he says, I wonder why a reformer is a saintly prophet, if I agree with him, but a heretic if I disagree. And one that makes me very nervous, I wonder why the Lord does not always put the desire to preach and the ability to do so in the same people. This man is a preacher, but he has no glib and easy faith, which he packages on Sunday morning and passes on with a beatific smile. I think his people down in New Braunfels, Texas, are very lucky. Now, still under the rubric of questions, George Gallup, the pollster, has recently asked some questions in a poll he took about Americans and the Bible, and I thought you might like to hear some of the results. You will not be surprised to learn that while Americans revere the Bible, they do not read it very much. I found it almost impossible to believe that fewer than half of all adults can name the four Gospels. just went through them. Mentally, I know what you did. State how many disciples there were, or identify the town where Jesus was said to have been born. Now, it's hard for anyone who is in church every Sunday to imagine that among college graduates, only 4 in 10 know that Jesus delivered the Sermon on the Mount. There is some good news for those who approach the Bible as we do. And here's the place where you may have to have some forgiveness for me. Despite all the publicity given to fundamentalism and to TV evangelists of that persuasion, the ratio of Americans who are fundamentalists continues to decline. And that was a great surprise to me. Only 31% now believe that the Bible is always to be taken literally, word for word, down 3 more percentage points from 1985. Education seems to be the major variable in all this, with belief in the literal truth of every part of the Bible decreasing according to educational background. Literalism in reading the Bible characterizes 45% of those with less than a high school degree, 34% among high school graduates, 26% among those with some college, and down to 11% among college graduates. Now, my boyhood fundamentalist church knew this a long time ago without benefit of polls, which is why it instructed our mothers and fathers to keep us away from universities and send us to Bible colleges where our faith would be preserved. But for thousands of us, in all kinds of churches around the country, it did not work. Taught to ask only the right questions and to get pre-recorded and approved answers to them, we wanted to ask other questions. And when we did, we learned things we were not supposed to know. I came to believe that if my faith is too shaky to survive in the questioning atmosphere of the academic world, it is probably not strong enough for grown-up life and needs to become something which is not simply handed down to me and uncritically and passively accepted, but is a hard-won and unique possession. And finally, a comment about church members. And I think you can relax now because I will not require forgiveness for this section. Someone asked me the other day to say something about the ways in which people relate to a church when they join it. The simplest fact is that church members break down into 2 broad camps: consumers and participants. Like any other realistic minister, I know I not only accept this, but I'm grateful for both camps. I wish for more participants, but I've spent too many years around churches to expect the usual ratio to change much. Churches are willing to accept into membership those who join whatever group will offer most of what it is they want: music, preaching, children's programs, lovely surroundings, convenience to where they live, an occasional handy place for christenings, weddings, and funerals. Words like sacrifice and commitment tend not to be part of the invitation as modern churches seek to swell their membership rolls. The biggest churches offer huge Easter and Christmas spectacles planned for months in advance and featuring live bunnies, sheep for the manger scene, and even an occasional reluctant camel borrowed from somebody's private animal farm. They advertise, I see these things, pop singers, professional athletes, beauty queens, and film stars in an attempt to get the essentially non-religious to come through the doors into a church. There are special interest groups for almost every conceivable lifestyle, for singles, for the recently divorced, for the bereaved, for those with drug problems, for parents who need child care while they work. The list is endless. In a world accustomed to television spectaculars and service industries, this has become the way to build huge churches. The church must entertain, and it must fill some need other than simply religious or spiritual. Among those who come for these reasons, there will be the faithful insiders, deeply involved, serving on boards, here when the work parties are announced. They may not always be likable people. Some of them may be prickly people, but they are essential. We can't live without them. There will be the Sunday at 10 group, good people who just don't want more church than that, but do value the worship hour. There'll be the, if I'm not at the lake or the golf course, people, equally good neighbors, just a different set of priorities. And along with all of these, what church studies call the permanent guest list, the ones who like to come and enjoy what we offer, but have no wish for any deeper involvement and simply trust the rest of us to keep the place going. Well, we welcome all of you. The level of involvement you choose is, after all, your decision and no one else's. But when we plan the church's work for a year in advance, we have to do it realistically, depending on the options chosen by those who come to this place. We make certain adjustments in the budget, in the programs we can sponsor, in how high to let the grass grow before we cut it. Those of us for whom the church is essential always secretly hope that some of the others will elect to move up to a higher level of participation, but then that's how the deeply captured always feel, even when they know in their hearts it is not realistic. So, consumer or participant, taker or giver, faithful or fringe, we greet you gladly and hope that wherever you find yourself right now, the church will come to mean more and more as you make the trip. In the words of that wonderful folksy commercial, stop by, we'll leave the light on for you.